Hello again. Welcome to another New Energy Chinwag with Charlie Ratton and myself, John Massey. Hi, Charlie.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. Hi, John.
So, kind of big news this week, at least if you're in the UK, has been a 10-point plan. It's always important if you've got a plan to have a number of points, I guess, and some numbers like 7 or 3 don't seem very good, but 10 seems like a good number. So we thought today we'd have a little delve into what that is. It only came out it came out at kind of 10:30 at night on Wednesday night. So really it came out yesterday morning, as far as most people are concerned. So I guess delving straight in, Charlie, there's some things that we've talked about. What kind of struck you from the plan, and I guess what struck you that may be different from what we might have been expecting before?
Well, I suppose regular listeners shouldn't be too surprised, should they? We've tried to give people a bit of a heads up as to some of the key elements of what you might call the energy transition. And like you, I'm a fan of these 10 point plans. Luckily I do have 10 fingers, so I can just about count to 10. And there were 10 points, weren't there, in the industrial strategy of Theresa May a couple of years ago with its 10 pillars. And obviously I think our Prime Minister is a pretty good communicator, and he's realised that 10 is a good number to focus the mind on. So starting, I suppose, at number one, and this won't be a surprise to our astute listeners, is this figure of 40 gigawatts by 2030. So that really, it just shows how far offshore wind has come. It's not a surprise, but it's still stated now in black and white. And that has really put together perhaps the 30 gigawatts of the southern UK, England, Wales, Northern Ireland, if you like, and added in ScotWind 10 gigawatts to it to bring this 40 gigawatts figure. It's a very, very ambitious target, 2030 from where we are. So a quadrupling. And he's given a few jobs. He says this will support 60,000 jobs. So it's the first time I've heard that figure quantified in the in the public domain. But I suppose, even though regular listeners won't be surprised at this summit, it just puts that in as an anchor, if you like. And this, it says offshore wind obviously is recognised as a success. We've talked about the sector deal in the past. We've talked about local content. And it's now nailed with a 40 gigawatt target by 2030. So that shows government political commitment. It's come from the Conservative Party, not always renowned for support for the wind industry, but is point number one on offshore wind. Is there anything you'd like to add to that that comment?
Yeah, well, I suppose before looking at other points, I mean, you've already raised, I think, what was the key, arguably the key driver for this, and you mentioned that the Conservatives have not necessarily always been the kind of most forward-looking in terms of climate change and so on, but arguably this is very much driven not by climate change per se, but jobs. I mean, you mentioned it. There's everywhere in all of these points, wherever you look, on all the statements, it was all about a kind of realization in the past. There's been the kind of Treasury view that, oh, this stuff's all a bit expensive. And it's sort of flipped over suddenly to, oh, this stuff could actually create us lots of new jobs and lots of economic recovery. So I think that's a big driver for all these things. And in particular, economic recovery in the kind of politically, the kind of locations which is quite helpful if you're a Conservative government. So I think we've got to kind of put it in that context as well. So jobs in the north, jobs in the east, jobs in parts of the world where they're keen to do. So yeah, offshore wind was one you mentioned. I mean, the other obvious one to delve into is the hydrogen side, simply because we've talked about that quite a bit. We're still waiting for hydrogen strategy, of course, which is coming early next year, and as with all these points, we're also waiting for some kind of detailed plans. But there were some interesting things in the hydrogen side.
It says first of all, on the jobs one, just to go back to that one briefly, it does say supporting up to 60,000 jobs, which is an important word. So it doesn't say 60,000 new jobs. So that's worth I know we like to read the tea leaves with these discussions, so that's always worth pointing out. But then it does go back. And again, regular Chinwag listeners won't be surprised to see hydrogen, which we've discussed on more than half a dozen podcasts around that subject in the last 18 months, 2 years. And it does give a figure. It says, working with industry, aiming to generate 5 gigawatts of low carbon hydrogen by 2030. Now, that is, I don't know what the current figure is, but I would imagine it's in the megawatts, the low megawatts of that 20s, 30s, to get from there to 5 gigawatts within a decade.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because it's looking at, I mean, they talk about, they don't just talk about renewable power, they're talking about carbon capture and storage as well. And certainly there are, so that 5 gigawatts, it's not clear to me, and it's not clear from the document, whether that's, if you're in the green hydrogen game, you'd kind of read that as 5 gigawatts of electrolyzers, but I'm not sure that I'm reading it as that.
This is low carbon, so I think the baseline is low carbon.
Green as well as blue in there, possibly, as well.
Yeah, yeah. I interpret it that way as well. But looking at that figure, I would say it's going to need more than one cluster to get to that. I would say two or three clusters must be needed to get to that. It's a massive ramp up. I don't know if you're familiar with what the figure is now, but it's just a niche at the moment, and it's perhaps 20, 50, possibly tops megawatts.
It's tiny. And if you look at some of the individual clusters, like the one in the northwest, they were looking at a hydrogen, that's blue hydrogen, and they were looking at an output of about 800 megawatts, is it, or something? Okay. So you'd be looking at five or so clusters, or maybe three or four big clusters, and then a whole bunch of smaller projects. So certainly a big thing. The other thing that kind of, I guess, will kind of excite and annoy people in equal measure, depending who they are, is there's some interesting mentions of, and I'm just going to find the word, they talked about a hydrogen neighborhood, and then they talked about hydrogen village, and eventually hydrogen town. Now, they don't say how big a neighborhood is compared to a village.
It's funny you mention that. I mean, there are a few things worth teasing out. I remember that Leeds had a big hydrogen ambition at one time, and that seems to have gone a little bit quiet. Some of the key drivers, I think they ended up with Equinor, some of the people behind that, and so that's gone a little bit quiet over there, because that was always, I think it was Leeds 2021 or something, that was called. So that's gone a bit quiet. Now, looking at this, you've already mentioned that we don't yet have a strategy. I'm even wondering whether there's going to be two strategies, one south of the border and almost a Scottish strategy as well, because I certainly expect one of these hydrogen hubs or clusters to be north of the border. I'd be astonished if that wasn't to be the case. And then you might be looking at the one, the Humber. I think there's one in the east of England. They're cropping up all the time. It depends on where you listen to. There seem to be about 8 carbon capture clusters in the UK, but other people then say, well, we want a cluster too, and we've got some of the ingredients, and we want this. And then you might argue that Orkney might be considered an existing cluster.
Yeah, I think... I think we need to separate out there, because when they're talking from a clustering point, they're looking really at industrial clusters. But the interesting thing about what they're talking about, so 2023, we will support industry to begin hydrogen heating trials in a local neighbourhood. And then by 2025, a large village hydrogen heating trial again. So, I mean, the difference there is they're obviously intending to look at least at hydrogen and roll out some demo projects of hydrogen from a heating point of view, which again will be, I mean, that is vying, it's vying actually with one of the other points in their document. So it'll be interesting to see, because which one is it? Greener buildings, I guess it probably is that number 20? 600,000 heat pump installations per year by 2028. So there's some interesting kind of competitive different approaches in here. They're obviously keen on heat pumps, but they're also looking at some at least kind of demonstration trial, pilot, whatever you want to call them, for hydrogen heating as well. So it's interesting that they've kind of they're kind of hedging their bets a bit on technology.
I don't blame them for that. I think we've got the HyDeploy 1, which was at Kiel. I think there was a trial up at a place called Spadeadam. I think that might be a military type of thing up on the borders. There was also due to be a place at Winlayton up at Gateshead. That was going to be what you might call that neighbourhood thing that you mentioned there. Whether that was just heat or whether that was just up to 20% injection into everything, the existing gas
blending.
Grid.
That was blending into the network. Yeah. But for, the one in Kiel that's kind of going at the moment is that's heating. It's domestic and also some university building heating as well. So it's definitely blending hydrogen with gas to do heating. So yeah, so it's interesting that that gets a mention specifically around hydrogen.
And I'm sure that I came across a planning application at Aberdeen for 300 houses to have. That was part of a bigger application. And I'll keep an eye on that one as well and see what happens with these 300 houses, what kind of system they put in place for that to make that happen.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess other than that, that was kind of the main bit that leapt out at me about hydrogen, was the fact that they were actually. They're definitely keen to look at the whole blending thing, which again, as I say, will annoy some people, which will excite others, depending
side of the lobby. We talked about the ramp up for offshore wind, but if you were to do the multiples or the multipliers from where we are now to get to 5 gigawatts within 10 years, I think you're looking at half a dozen plus clusters to get to that kind of figure.
Mm. Yeah, that, I mean, it's effectively, well, clean hydrogen, it's effectively kind of a standing start, isn't it? So that's a big one. We've talked about offshore wind and hydrogen quite a bit. Moving down the list, nuclear, we had a guest on.
We had a very interesting chat with Brian, didn't we, a few weeks ago, and he was going through the various forms of it. And it looks that smaller one. Was it the SMRs he called them? The little half a megawatt? Yeah, the little ones, they seem to be the favoured. And presumably plonk these on the old, I remember a big scoping exercise about 10, 12 years ago where they were looking at 8-10 sites throughout the UK, often existing facilities, and I suppose they'd be the front runners for where you plant these. I presume they've got the grid in place and they've got some of the elements you would look for major projects out with national parks, with some of the constraints, so they might be front runners. Where they'll be sited, we'll see. But yes, there is a place for nuclear in there, which is interesting. Good news for Brian, of course.
Again, it's a kind of love it or hate it topic, I guess. But yeah, very much, I mean, looking at the blurb, big nuclear, where it's value for money, it says, which is probably going to be very, very rarely, you might argue. I mean, SMR, small modular reactors, and also they've got what they call advanced modular reactors. We'd have to check back to our interview with Brian to remind ourselves exactly what the difference was. But smaller stuff. They're keen on that. I mean, they're keen to push that. Interestingly, talking about AMRs, it says high-grade heat could unlock efficient production of hydrogen and synthetic fuel. Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, I've noticed a few things.
It's a strange one, isn't it? So, but I suppose the thing about nuclear is, like any electricity, it's traditionally used in real time. I suppose they might have investigated a few batteries and that kind of thing. But I suppose if you want to be serious about it, everybody is talking about hydrogen as one of the names of our own podcast. But it's interesting that Sizewell C have now got some kind of hydrogen scheme incorporated into the wider aspirations going forward. I've come across similar things in the United States as well. In that I heard it.
There's quite a bit of nuclear stuff. In France, where they've got lots of nuclear, and also a big hydrogen target now, they're looking at using nuclear. The Russians are looking at using nuclear. So, yes, I mean, I don't think that's kind of the driver for it, but certainly in terms of trying to make the business case better for nuclear, I think using the heat within hydrogen production is certainly going to be, I guess, if you're in the nuclear industry trying to make yourself more credible and more economic, then you're looking certainly for tie-ups. But it's interesting that despite all the issues around cost over Hinkley, the government are keen to support it. And again, you could argue it's not really just down to the economics, it's down to jobs and the investment and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think there might be a disguised military aspect to it as well. I think we are one of the five, aren't we? You need to keep the technology up. Brian said that we can't use the submarine kit, didn't he? He said there was some reason that we can't use the submarine type reactors, which is a bit of a thing, you know, if you work in a sub, stick it on shore and use it there. But there was some reason,
I think it was a regulatory reason. The rationale about that was. So that's kind of still in there. And then carbon capture.
That's not a surprise to us, is it? Because this has been around. We did a podcast on this very subject. This has had more false dawns than just about any tech. But it does seem to be finally making All of this stuff is, they've had all kinds of stuff, haven't they? Been come and gone, and then people have shuffled the pack around. But it all seems to be is now Boris has kind of put it into 10 points. And it's interesting that carbon capture is always going to be, I'm sure, a part of it. That will bring existing big players. They'll be very pleased at it. Big infrastructure companies, oil and gas majors, they're all going to be delighted that there's a place for carbon capture and storage. And doubtless some kind of support argument, some kind of lobbying will now be going on in the background to who pays for some of this, because it's not going to be cheap.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, it's a, I mean, some of these tie together very much. Obviously, that's going to tie in with the industrial cluster bit of it, the hydrogen bit of it, blue hydrogen, as well as green hydrogen. I mean, again, carbon capture, we've talked about it. It's something that the Climate Change Committee have pretty much said, well, we can't get to net zero without it. So it's how it's, again, the devil's going to be in the detail in terms of how they make the business case work, whether they're going to come up with a carbon price to do it. I don't think they can do, I don't think you can do it simply by kind of throwing R&D money at it. You want private money, and you want, so really it's more going to be around, I would suggest, around the regulatory environment to make that private money see a profit at the end of it, which is probably more about carbon pricing or some kind of carbon valuation mechanism that makes it worth doing. But definitely it's been floating around there. I mean, I guess you could argue this list is kind of covering absolutely everything possible. Well, so we don't know.
It's a bit of a hedge list with everything in there. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just see which one's a bit of competition between techs isn't a bad thing. But it does seem, I mean, we've been, we talked about carbon capture and storage being around with methane. It was around for about 15 years ago, and then it went into last year we did a podcast at this time, and we were talking about fracking, and I can't see fracking on that. So that's one thing that perhaps might not be on there.
That's kind of disappeared off the horizon rather swiftly.
Why?
fairly obvious reasons. If you thought wind turbines were popular, then wait till you. Someone turns up and starts fracking in the field next door. So, that's an interesting one. Actually, the kind of gas production side of it has kind of disappeared off the horizon a little bit. Again, there's some other, I mean, obvious things. EVs are in there.
Emphasis
on transport.
EVs were already in Theresa May's. There was a 10-point industrial strategy about 2 or 3 years ago. And it's really one of her major behests to the UK. And obviously, Boris Johnson now is looking for recovery options, isn't he? We're going to need something. We talked about this in a previous line, and he's probably picked up this list and thought, well, actually, some very interesting things in here. And I think EVs were already part of Theresa May's 10 points as well. So he's just rehashed that and put them in here, and very wisely too, because, well, perhaps you're closer to the EV pulse than I am, but it does seem to be talk of gigafactories and all kinds of, I think we in the Northwest nearly got one in Manchester. And I'm sure that there will be some in some of the clusters you'll find, I'm sure there'll be some kind of EV element to some of these industrial clusters.
Yeah, I mean, EVs is an obvious one because we are, although people bemoan the lack of sort of British car companies as in brands, we're still one of the biggest car manufacturing countries. We produce an awful lot of cars. It's just that they're made by Honda, Nissan, and whoever else. So, I mean, if you're not going down the EV line, you basically, the danger is you don't have a car industry anyway, because that's where the car industry is going. But I think also what came out of this was the desire not to just be dependent on importing all the bits and pieces. So I think you're right, things like battery gigafactories is going to be, there's something that they're keen to look at. There's the usual stuff about kind of charge points. I mean, some of that is the whole thing about charge points, I think sometimes can be a bit overblown in terms of you could have a gazillion charge points, but if not enough people are using them, if they're underutilized, how do you make the case for it? So I think it's still a bit of an unknown as to how many charge points are enough. I mean, most people charge at home, so you could argue actually you don't need zillions of charge points elsewhere, you need them in the right place rather than millions of them in the wrong place. So I think there'll be a bit more focus on fast charging and fast charging hubs to complement slower charging at home. So that's kind of an obvious one. I mean, it talks about it's cars and vans at the moment, is how it's phrased. What's not in here, I don't think it appears anywhere in the other sections, is kind of the heavier transport.
Yeah, well, that might bring us back to our own hydrogen again, if there's progress on that side of things, if they want to get to net zero. Certainly they're looking at HGVs in other countries, and we'll see how that strand goes. Coming back to the cost, I mean, if you're a UK PLC and everybody's charging these vehicles at home, it means you're not going to get your money from your petrol, you're not going to get your revenues or your diesel. So how are you going to charge? Are you going to put toll roads in and say, well, look, you know, we can't really charge you, just put your domestic tariff or whatever your electric cost to fill this in, but we need our money from somewhere. So how are we going to get that back?
Yeah, well, there was it wasn't an official statement, but there was some leaked Treasury kind of consultation document, I think, floating around earlier the same week, where they were obviously looking at road pricing as the way to do that. So price, I guess, pay per mile, that kind of thing. But yeah, they'll certainly have to replace tax revenue from fuels by tax on transport by some other mechanism. And as you say, it's going to be hard to do that on electricity, but it's going to be, so you're probably looking, it makes more sense then to do it on things like pay per mile, road pricing, whatever it may be. I think the barriers to that, I mean, in some ways it makes a lot of sense. Why, if you use the road more, why shouldn't you pay more tax or more of the tax? The barrier there is going to be the old favourites like privacy, and the fact that to do that, if you're tracking where people are driving and what time they're driving and so on, do people want a black box in their car that's collecting that data on which the tax is based? So I think the issues there are going to be less around whether you can do it and whether it's in theory a fair system, but in practice whether people get a bit sniffy about the fact that
we live in strange times, John. I think we're getting more used to being a bit less sniffy about certain things. I've got a whole heap of apps on my phone that do an awful lot of stuff, and if somebody said, well, we'll give you a bit of a price reduction, or we'll get a better insurance deal if you put this app on, then you might be more that perhaps the carrot is perhaps a better mechanism than the old privacy stick.
I mean, people are funny, aren't they, about privacy? I mean, they're quite happy to have a kind of reward card for the supermarket that saves them money, even though that's giving the supermarket an enormous amount of information about what they do, whether they own a dog, whether they have children, all that kind of stuff based on what they buy. But yeah, they then get a bit funny about having a smart meter, for example. So it's people, there are kind of slight illogicalities to a lot of this stuff.
Can't see any figures for electric vehicles. It just says backing our world-leading car manufacturing bases. So I can't see any target of, you know, 3 million EVs by 2035 or anything of that nature, not like some of the other stuff we've addressed.
That's a good question. Let me just get to the right page. I mean, the main headlines were obviously around phasing out pure petrol and diesel by 2030 and then hybrids by 2035. That's the main numbers. It talks about gigafactories and who they can employ. We will invest $1.3 billion to accelerate the rollout of charging infrastructure, so some money going into charging infrastructure. But there's not, just stuff about jobs and so on, but that's the main thing, is the here we go. 2030, we expect the network of charge points on motorways and A roads to be more than 2,500 high powered charge points by 2030, and then 6,000 by 2035. Actually, in the same section, it does talk about, actually, we will consult on a date for phasing out the sale of new diesel heavy goods vehicles.
Right. Okay.
So they're going to invest in freight trials to pioneer hydrogen and other zero emission lorries. So it's mentioned, but it's not. They're consulting on it rather
than. Okay, well, I mean. I mean, obviously, nobody's going to be investing in diesel technology now, are they? All the investment money is now going to go to the alternative. So I think if you're a diesel company now, you'd be looking at that pretty hard and saying, well, where do the opportunities lie for us in the future away from diesel? And perhaps there's some smart moves for I know it's been consulted, but I would urge them to think about what's happening now rather than waiting for it 5 years down the line.
Yeah. I mean, the one area of transport actually where they have got a specific point is flying and boats, flying and ships. People get funny about boats versus ships, don't they? be careful which one I use.
I'm one of them.
So, it's Jet Zero, as they call it. The thing that they already established around...
kind of turn phrase about it.
Trying to develop zero emission aircraft that could enter service by 2030.
I've seen some stuff coming through from Airbus and other things. Yeah, I don't think it's in the first tranche of the new hydrogen economy, but 10 years down the line, and I suppose it's not going to be cheap either. I suppose it's going to be who pays again for all of this, and perhaps an industry that perhaps needs support. But things are different now. We've talked about that in other podcasts, and if you're looking for future and wins, then you're considering the options like aircraft and so forth, and why not?
Yeah, so in the short run, they're talking about consulting on sustainable aviation fuel mandate to blend green fuels into kerosene. So, I mean, it doesn't, I mean, that could be biofuels. We've had, there are bio aviation fuels, so it'll be interesting to see how they take that forward. But, I mean, they're obviously, that's an interesting one, because obviously that's the aviation side is, it's a long-term bet rather than a short-term thing.
Absolutely.
And then it already mentions about hydrogen ferry trials in Orkney. So a potential hydrogen refueling port in Teesside. So there's a few, and it's a bit thin on detail on aviation and maritime, but it kind of gets a mention of that.
If you're thinking of ports on Teesside, perhaps Middlesbrough and Hartlepool and these kind of places would be front runners for that.
And again, I think that obviously ties in very much with the whole industrial cluster side of things as well. So some of these are going to naturally blend together. I mean, if looking at those, I mean, offshore wind, hydrogen clusters, carbon capture, green shipping. I mean, they are all examples of things which
I've certainly heard Teesside being mentioned increasingly in the kind of tea leaves or the dispatches that we kind of follow. It seems to be creeping up the agenda. It seems to be linked up, and obviously there's offshore wind farms. I think some of the Dogger Bank and some of the offshore wind farms off the east coast are going to start coming on stream. Obviously you've got a big industrial base there. You've got an existing chemical industry. They're not going to be scared of some of the logistics side of things, and you've got quite a reasonable infrastructure as well. So you can see why that'd be an attractive proposition. As if there's going to be a battle between the clusters, if you like, a beauty parade. I think they're creeping up the table. They're coming through.
Yeah, but I think for some of these things to work, because it is an ambitious kind of sort of wish list, if you like, but for some of them to work, some of these points are going to happen together at the same time. Not going to happen independently of each other. They're going to happen in combination. Again, we've kind of talked a little bit about that before. There's the other ones we've talked a bit less about. It talks about green public transport. We've talked a bit about rail, I guess. So developing cleaner rail.
I mean, obviously, I mean, that's a logical one, isn't it? I mean, you've obviously got a large part of the rail network already electrified.
Yeah.
And the hard to electrify areas, such as the Settle Car Line, I've certainly seen maps indicating that this, I think there's a factory up at Widnes, Alstom, that already makes hydrogen trains and exports them to Europe. I think there's some tweaks needed for the UK network. I think we need to move some of the catenary kit away from where the hydrogen is, so there might be some design work going on, but I can certainly see a place for it. So certainly the hard to electrify areas, you know, the hard to reach bits, hydrogen seems to be well placed for the expensive bits, the small loading gauges, the lines that are kind of difficult. There might be, I'm thinking of the trans the east west lines and things like that, and certainly some of the Scottish lines would be a good place to trial some of this. I've seen battery trains.
I mean, Alstom, for example, make battery trains as well. So it'll boil down technology choice, but rail.
Could the batteries charge from hydrogen? Could you use the two? I mean, you put the two together, some kind of fuel cell come battery come, who knows what the combination of the.
Sure, there are hybrid versions. It's ultimately going to come down to what range they need, how quickly they need to go, how much weight they're pulling, how many carriages they're going to pull. Both exist in Europe.
They're running in Europe, so I'm sure that some of this will certainly happen without question. So absolutely. Other transport buses, I mean, we saw those things, didn't we, at All Energy, those double-deck buses with the hydrogen in the boot effectively. I think Aberdeen and Liverpool and London have bought the double-deck hydrogen buses, and I can see more following if those are successful as well, more fleets as cities with the net zero cities. I would have thought their procurement must be geared to things like that, bin lorries, who knows what other public transport and other infrastructure.
This is a milestone, 2021, first of 4,000 new zero emission buses delivered.
I've seen quite a high profile company lobbying for that, and they've done quite well, I think. They're quite good. Good news for them. So good on them.
Interesting. Maybe in 2050, for all we know, but anyway. And then obviously, lots of good stuff about cycling and walking. So it'll be interesting to see if some of the cities.
Yeah, I mean, we splashed out on an e-bike. I'd be distraught if there was going to be a mile, if this new mile gizmo came in and said, well, you cycled 20 miles today, Charlie, you're on the hook for 20 quid or whatever this new costing.
Yeah, but it'd be interesting to see. one of the things that people liked about, but one of the positive impacts potentially around COVID was some of the opening up of some of the city centres in terms of less traffic, more cycle lanes, that kind of stuff. So it'd be interesting to see how much of that kind of stays in place. It suggests some of this kind of strategic goals here, at least, that they're keen to keep some of that in place.
It's cycling and walking as well, which is good. I mean, I went to a Manchester event and I thought, well, that's great, but does it bear in mind the Manchester climate, which is about 364 days a year bucketing rain? And I thought, well, it's all very well. It's all very well to think of that, but you know, I just wanted to be realistic. But things have changed even since then, so who knows what's going to come through.
And then I guess, I mean, just to round off the ones we've not mentioned yet, where are we? We've talked about that. Planting trees, I think, came up somewhere.
I'm not surprised. That's an old favourite. I mean, it's nice to see it incorporated there. There's obviously a good news story around them to be thought about, but that's nice to see. There's also one that I'd like to pick up on, and that's on homes and public buildings. I always thought that certain areas seem to be quite resistant to the net zero agenda. And I'm thinking about the government itself. I'm thinking about schools, the NHS, universities. Some of them have got quite big estates, even football grounds and things like that. Have they really, you know, charities? Everybody's part of society. But just because you might have a noble objective doesn't mean that you're above the wider societal drivers. And I think there's a big place now for organisations to look at what they are, what the building stock is, whether they've got rooftops, whether they've got grounds, and do something with different technology. I was always surprised that some of the organisations that talk the noblest talk didn't actually engage. They are, and now they'll have to. They'll have to come up with net zero plans, and that might be a bit of a shock to some of them.
Yeah. No, makes sense to start at home if you're public sector.
That target of 600,000 heat pumps. How realistic? How many peat pumps are bashed out at the moment? I mean, that sounds like a giant ramp up from where we are as well. I don't know what the figures are for heat pumps.
But it is a big ramp up. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what the number is, but I would be. I don't think it says from here what the current thing is. 600,000 heat pumps per year by 2028. I mean, I'm thinking it's probably in the tens of thousands at most. That would be my guess.
It's a massive increase.
It's a big ramp up. Yeah.
Presume most of those would imagine new builds rather than the going into retrofit.
I don't think you could reach that target simply by new build. Well, maybe you could. It depends how many new homes are getting built. But if you're going to address kind of the heating issue in the UK, then ultimately you've got to start addressing the however many, whatever it is, 30 million households, 25 million households, whatever it is. So you've got to look at retrofit as well. I mean, been kind of notoriously hit and miss, I guess, on the whole heating, the kind of green heat incentives, renewable heat incentive, the various green deals and all that kind of stuff have been a bit problematic, really, in terms of how they've worked.
600,000, John, that's per year. So if that's by 2028, 29, 30, so you're talking about 1.5 million plus heat pumps just with us 3 years without even getting there. So that's a massive increase from where we are now. So if you are a heat pump manufacturer and you've got some good kit, I think you can look forward to
it. One of the challenges always with, it says it's an ambition. One of the challenges always with these kind of things, and that's why it matters when an ambition turns into actual policy. One of the dangers, of course, is if you create massive demand, then you can also keep prices high. I mean, arguably that happened in the past with things like solar, rooftop solar. I mean, you created massive demand with feed-in tariffs, and the manufacturers had people knocking on their door saying, I want some solar panels. And needless to say, they think, oh, great. Well, there's no reason for us to lower our prices because demand's enormous. So one of the challenges, of course, if you create a boom, is you can also end up doing it quite expensively. So it'll be interesting to see how they can handle some of that's why the detail matters in terms of how you actually turn these ambitions into actual policy. I have just noticed, because I was looking at one of the last one on the list is green finance and innovation. And actually, I was kind of thinking that will all be about they've talked about green bonds and green sovereign fund and so on. But I noticed hidden away in there is we're doubling down on our ambition to be the first country in the world to commercialize fusion energy technology. So there you go.
It's in there.
So there's a few extra things
fusion's always, it always seems to be just a couple of years after reach, doesn't it, without being overly cynical about it. I mean, it's like you say, it's something for everybody, I think, in there. So I don't think any sector is going to be necessarily disappointed, unless you're in a coal. I can't say anything about coal mines. And there was that one consented in Cumbria, wasn't there, bizarrely? So I don't know what's happened to that one at the moment.
I remember looking at that, and I think that was specifically, it wasn't coal for kind of power plant, it was coking coal. I'm sure that was about coal for the steel industry. So it was a slightly different, you could argue. But it wasn't about creating new kind of power plants burning coal and producing emissions that way. It was looking at, I'm sure it was industrial use coal, which again, it'll be phased out eventually because we're looking at ways to reduce industrial emissions. But yeah, I think as we've said, I mean, there's so many things in here. The devil will be in the detail in terms of how these turn into actual policies. And I mean, on that front, there's actually, at least on the document I'm looking at, there's various documents exist around this, but it points out there's a whole bunch of things that need to come into play. So it talks about the energy white paper, the transport decarbonisation plan, industrial decarbonisation strategy, hydrogen strategy. So actually, there's a load of kind of legislation, load of stuff that we're waiting on to see how this turns into activity.
People are working on these, though. That's not from a standing start.
No.
The commentary that I've heard about is some of the figures involved. And it's not all about figures here. It's about direction of travel, I feel.
Yeah, but
there's been some commentary about the amount spent about HS2 in comparison to how much money is actually on the table, and whether some of this is just rehashed policy. We mentioned the offshore wind sounds bright and shiny and new and 10-point plan, but we've talked 2 years about this 40 gigawatt target. But I suppose it's nice to see it codified, and it does send a message out. We talk a lot to investors. I think they'll take comfort from the fact that, especially a regime that's not been especially favourable for renewables, it's sometimes been a hard slog. But when you hear Prime Minister of a Conservative Party standing up party conference and extolling the versions of wind, you have to almost rub your eyes if you've been in it as long as I have. But I suppose that's good news. Let's not forget that this is actually, if you're into clean tech and renewables, this is a good news thing, that it comes from the Prime Minister himself and with a bit of drum banging and all the rest of it. So from people like ourselves, it's a positive story. And yes, you can quibble about how much money is on the table and so forth, but there is some support there, and there is some money on the table for it, which is positive.
I think that's what I was kind of thought we could look at in kind of finishing off, is more kind of the reactions to it and some of the commentary around it. I would. It's kind of something for everyone. It's kind of sub thumping. It's kind of, it's very much direction of travel. It doesn't say anything about how realistic any of this stuff is, whether we'll get there and so on. But I think the key thing is, as you said, I mean, it really is a sea change in terms of how not just government as a whole, but in particular this flavour of government, if you like, politically, has seen the sector. Yeah. And it really is a bit of an, I wouldn't say it's a complete about turn, but it's definitely a strong statement of intent and direction of travel, which is important for kind of setting the framework. Now, I mean, in terms of, I mean, reactions, there's been all sorts of reactions to it. There's obviously the people who, for whom, even if you wanted to do all this by next Thursday, would still be too slow. So there's the usual criticisms of, is it fast enough and so on. But the money one's interesting. I mean, my perspective on that is that actually, I don't think we're not looking at this as a kind of a state-sponsored public sector enterprise. This is surely about the importance is going to be not how much money the government puts in, but how they set up the regulatory environment through which the private sector can put money in. That would be more. That's what I'm kind of more interested in. I mean, arguing about they could put in 5 billion rather than 3 billion, to me, is kind of misses the point a little bit. I think what the private sector are looking for are just a clear set of policies and rules which enable them to make a profit.
Well, you've got almost your 10 commandments here, haven't you, now? And they do echo those other 10 in the industrial strategy. And if you want a nice, clear direction of travel, here it is in black and white. I've got a one-page version of it, and you can just read through it and you say, well, it's very positive news. It couldn't be clearer. There are some losers, of course. Who would you say the losers are in all of this? The extractive guys and the fossil industries? I mean, they must have been prepared for this. They must have known what was coming. We've talked about it the last 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, clearly you could argue they're going to be losers in the energy transition anyway. So I don't think this fundamentally changes the fact that would happen. It probably changes the rate at which it happens. And I guess that's the importance of including things like carbon capture and storage in there, because they're sort of offering them okay, we're closing this door, but we invite you to walk through this door instead. As I say, carbon capture, hydrogen, you could maybe include in there as well. I think from that sense, they're kind of giving them a kind of another route to go down, which I think is
important. Yeah, you could argue with some of the strategic acquisitions with an offshore wind, for example. I went down to London last year. And a lot of the developers now offshore oil and gas majors. It's not like the old days where it was a utility game. They're now moving in and with fantastic names like giga projects and things like that. And they're going on a scale to match 10 gigawatt offshore projects. Unthinkable, not so long ago. So they're bringing their heft from the oil and gas background and starting to link together some of these hybrid schemes that we've talked together. And they've realised this. They knew this was coming. They've got their fingers on the pulse. They've got lobbyists. They talk to government a lot. And perhaps they knew 5 or 6 years ago that the pivot was already underway. Yeah. So that's not a shot.
I mean, I suppose two things notable by their absence, as far as I can tell, are onshore renewables. So there's no mention of onshore wind or solar in it, for example. They still seem to be missing from the story. And I know that's drawn some criticism from obviously people in those sectors. It'll be interesting to see how they come in with the energy white paper. I mean, it may be the case that they reappear in a kind of CFD pot in some form, but it certainly doesn't read from this that there's going to be any particular drive, for example, in planning and permitting conditions to increase onshore renewables. It's very much an offshore focused strategy. Sure. So I guess you could argue they're losers, at least in the UK, from that.
Yeah, but you could argue that a lot of onshore developers are also offshore developers, and although they might lose onshore, turbines obviously getting a lot bigger for the wind game. If you're putting a 300 meter turbine up, which is what you're having offshore, then I think it's perhaps too big to be safely seated and a landscape and visual point of view onshore anyway. And perhaps they also knew yeah, all right, they might have lost a little bit. There might be a few repowerings going on strategically. But I think they perhaps realised that that's why they went offshore in the first instance, to allow that scalability that we've talked about in the past, and that they were already, like the oil and gas companies, prepared and knew it was coming.
Yeah, I wouldn't entirely, follow that. But I mean, I think a big chunk of the reason why, from a government's point of view, particularly a conservative government point of view, a big reason it went offshore was that in the places where you might want to build it, the people just didn't like having turbines scattered yeah. around the countryside. And I mean, that's not entirely unreasonable, but in fact, you can site them in the wrong place. But I think, we'll see in some parts of the country, in Scotland, for example, you'll still see onshore, I'm sure. You'll still see solar as well, just simply because it won't be relying on subsidy and so on anyway. But then you could argue in terms of the big picture of the UK energy mix, solar, it's not our greatest resource, so it has a useful role to play. We've got lots of it installed. Certainly in the spring, it was a big contributor to the energy yeah. picture, but over the year, I guess if you're picking resources to look at, then offshore is definitely, offshore and offshore wind is definitely one of the bigger ones. Other losers, hard to pick any out. I mean, I'm sure there are some people screaming at their podcast device of choice and saying, "What about me?" But
yeah, I mean, if you're in a diesel innovation centre, might not be the most kind of vibrant place at the moment, or if you're in the fracking research centre or something like that, you wouldn't be too much comfort in here. Coming back to the innovation bit, was there any other innovation mentioned? Was there anything for the catapults or anything for a bit besides the fusion stuff? Was there anything else in there?
No, I think we've lots of mentions of targeted trials in, as I say, around rail, around heating, around clusters and boats and all that kind of stuff. So I think we've probably mentioned most of them. There's various kind of throwaway lines hidden in there which could turn out to be quite significant. But no, I think we've covered most of it. Again, from an innovation point of view, I mean, the last point is finance and innovation, which I guess is why that's got the fusion stuff in there. Tees mentions again 3 million in the Tees Valley Hydrogen Transport Hub. So, I mean, again, I would class that, I would tie that in with the clustering side of things as well. Yeah, I mean, they're obviously through the clusters. I mean, again, that will come out of the devil will be in the detail of what actually is announced in the various kind of papers and stuff coming through. I mean, there's some innovation in the finance itself. That made news, actually. That was sort of briefed prior to this, wasn't it? The thing about the first sovereign green bond being issued next year. So mm-hmm. buying government bonds, but particularly around green investment. So there's a few, but yeah, I don't think there's anything major. As I say, I think some of the innovations that to make this happen actually might have to be around, for example, once we leave Europe, what happens around carbon pricing and carbon markets. How's that gonna feed into this? So we're kind of waiting to see some of those details.
I think you've just raised a very interesting point there. Because obviously this isn't going to happen in isolation. We've talked in our other podcasts about everybody's coming up with various strategies of various hues and colours and roadmaps. And even today, I think there was an offshore wind strategy from Europe with some eye-wateringly ambitious offshore wind figures mentioned. And so although it's great to be quadrupling, so is everybody else. We're not just in isolation, whether we might be out of Europe, but we're still going to stay aligned to the direction of travel within the energy industry. We have to be to be integrated and exporting to it. So there's a much bigger picture, and this is perhaps a UK element of a much, much bigger picture, where energy is almost at the forefront now, isn't it, of the industrial strategies, and is becoming quite a vibrant and exciting place to be at the centre of.
I mean, I think back to the innovation. I mean, tied in with I mentioned about leaving Europe. I mean, state aid. I mean, that's something that keeps cropping up in terms of being a sticking point for Brexit negotiations. I imagine, without being an expert on state aid, how that plays out will have an impact on how the government is able or not able to support its kind of favourite innovations of choice. So I suspect there'll be some things in here that will be dependent on the type of deal, if any, we see come the 1st of January. So I think there's going to be some of the kind of policy and business environment around what can and can't be done is also going to depend on other things that are going on. And certainly, I mean, we've post January, again, there's lots of stuff about trade deals and negotiating trade deals. I mean, again, I think a lot of this stuff will be in, there'll be an eye to those trade deals in here as well. They're obviously looking at not just creating jobs and economic activity at home, but there's definitely looking at, okay, rather than just kind of let things happen, let's identify what, as a country, we have natural advantages in, and drive those.
For sure.
Because also, there's export revenues and trade opportunities with it as well. Yeah. I think with oil and gas, I can't remember the figures, but I think as a country, we make way more money now out of the kind of knowledge side, the consulting and the expertise and the skills around oil and gas, which is exported around the world. So you can generate money, even though you might only have control over the physical oil and gas within British waters, you can still generate lots of money around that topic. Yeah. And I think the same will be true here. If we become one of the first countries to commercialise carbon capture, for example, carbon capture and storage, you'll have a whole business of consultants, innovation, knowledge, and so on, which, again, the big role will be to try and export that as well, further afield, even if the actual physical activity is happening in in another market. So I think there's a big element of that in here as well.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, I agree with that. Concur with that. Absolutely, it's a much bigger picture, and perhaps another argument for Bunty to be the first mover with all the advantages that go with it, the degree of pain involved, as with offshore wind. But there might be some big advantages, and something those advantages might go on for years afterwards. Whatever happens to the initial industry, for sure.
Mm.
Anything else you want to say by means of wrapping up? I think it's a pretty thorough look through these 10 points of the announcement this week. Some old, some new, something for everybody by the sounds of it, perhaps fossils perhaps accepted.
We'd kind of preempted some of it in our discussions up to now anyway, which is always good. We're sort of in the right place. And I'd say I think I'm quite positive about it. I mean, I don't think you'd read it as I'm reading a lot of the targets and numbers with a massive pinch of salt, but I think the direction of I think it's good to have the ambition. I think it's good to kind of set the priorities and set kind of where the government's looking at going. There's obviously something there for everyone, and not all of these things will happen, but if you don't try them all, I think if you don't try stuff, you never know. So there's lots of people making assumptions about their sector and particularly other sectors that they're competing with and saying, well, we must do everything like this and we can't have that. I think the government's job is going to be to set the kind of playing field by which you can kind of start down the road, you can get money involved, private sector can risk money on different technologies, you see which ones work, and then you go with the ones that are successful. So some people are a bit bar humbug about it, but I'm quite positive about it without being kind of blinkered that it's kind of anything set in stone. So I think it's to be applauded. I'd rather it was there than it wasn't there, certainly.
Excellent. I think I would agree 100% with those sentiments.
Okay. Probably a good place to leave it. And we'll see you in another episode in the near future.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for listening.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. Bye.